Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Engaging Internal Comms. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. Hello, my name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. I hope you've been able to listen to the previous 15 episodes of the podcast. If you haven't already done so, you can listen to them on our website, which is engagingic.com, or you can listen to them via your podcast platform of choice, whether that's iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever. We have all of our back episodes listed on there as well. So next week, we have got a fantastic interview coming up with Susan Elliott. Susan Elliott is going to be talking to us all about what is employee engagement. Now, that might sound like an obvious answer to that question. If you work in that field, if you're working in employee engagement or internal communications or organizational development, but we're going to be really digging deeper into what we mean by employee engagement and what are some of the key drivers of employee engagement, particularly ones that we can influence and have an impact on. And also, obviously, what are the benefits of employee engagement? So it may be a topic that you think you know a lot about already, but it's always good to refresh your memory, but also to visit it from maybe a slightly different angle to that you've come at it from before. And Susan is a real expert in this area, has some really interesting things that she's going to be talking to us about and sharing with us. So if you've not already done so, it would be great if you could leave us some feedback on whatever podcast platform that you use. If you're listening on iTunes, it's great if you could leave us some feedback there. We do have a Facebook group, which you can join via our website, which is engagingic.com. There's a little box on there that you can click on, and that will take you to our Facebook group, which you can join, which is a kind of a members only, by invitation only, or you know, you have to apply to go onto it. So it's not that something that anyone can follow or join. So if you do want to join that, let us know. There's a little box to click on there and fill in a couple of questions just so we know you're not a robot, which I'm sure you're not because you're listening to this, and you can let us know join the group and join in some of the conversations that we're trying to start on there. That would be fantastic. If you could also subscribe to the show on your podcast platform, that is one of the key drivers of our visibility as a podcast for other people who are interested in the subject of employee engagement and internal communications, and that would be really helpful to us. So I'd really, really appreciate it if you could do that. So on to this episode's interview. As internal communicators, I think we probably all recognize one of our core challenges is how do we get our messages to be heard above the background noise, whether that's noise that's being generated internally within the organization or it's background noise that we're facing externally from external sources. And how do we get our messages across to our audience, whether that's employees, stakeholders, external stakeholders, etc. So I was very fortunate enough to speak to a real expert in this area who has written a fantastic book, which I've read and really thoroughly enjoyed, and I'd thoroughly recommend to all of you, and we will be discussing this during the interview. And that's the whole principle that we're going to be looking at. How do we create something? What are some of the core principles that we need to focus on in order to be able to help our messages stand out and really cut through all of that background noise that we're trying to deal with? So I really hope you enjoy this interview. I really enjoyed actually recording it and speaking to the interviewee. Okay, so today I'm going to be talking to Jamie Mustard, who's going to be telling us all about how we can stand out from the crowd in a world of a scarcity of attention. Jamie is the author of The Iconist, which is a book about the art and science of standing out. Jamie is a strategic multimedia consultant. He has a passion for teaching the science and art of the obviousness and helping professionals, change agents, artists, and businesses to confidently help them to make their messages and brands and stand out for their desired audiences. Jamie is also a graduate of the London School of Economics. Jamie, how are you?
I am well. Thank you for having me today.
It's an absolute pleasure. And Jamie, you are in Portland, Oregon. Now, many of our listeners are in the UK, and I know you know the UK and how bad our knowledge of American geography is. So, just correct me. You're in the top. That's the kind of top left-hand corner of the United States.
It's the top left-hand corner. It's probably the only small city in America that has a global brand of granola, well-made goods, and feisty riots. Yeah, we have. I don't know when this is going to air, but right now we're under martial law here.
Really? Oh, crikey. Okay, we'll maybe not go there then. So
a lot of your listeners, if they're watching the news, Portland's on the news almost every, you know, again, we don't know when this is going to air.
But fantastic. So that we've helped pinpoint where you are, but
okay.
let me just give a little bit of background to how I came across you. I heard you, you know, this is the kind of multimedia connected world we live in. I heard you being interviewed on an Australian podcast, and you kind of almost, I don't say this very often, but you kind of blew my mind with what you're talking about, because it kind of resonated for me on multiple levels, but it also explained what our business does, which, you know, kind of sounds a bit strange to have to listen to an American guy talking on an Australian podcast to tell me what my business actually does and the way that you do it. And that for me was kind of a sort of a real amazing moment. I bought you
American book. Guy that was educated at one of your fine universities.
Exactly. One of our jewels in our crown, as I think.
Yes.
So I bought the book, The Iconist. I absolutely loved it. Totally relevant messages. I'm really, really powerful. I want to kind of start off by, because it's an unusual name, and my spell checker on my word processor that I've written my notes out for has underlined it because it doesn't recognize it. Iconist. What is an iconist? Tell me all about it, Jamie, please.
An iconist is somebody that pushes through their own unease or discomfort and the constant thrum of messaging noise that goes on around them and figures out a way to get through, get attention, get engagement, and get their offering into the world. You know, I explain how something becomes iconic, and normally it takes something 50 years to become iconic. But with the primal laws and the formulas in my book, you can make something that would normally take something 50 years to become iconic through chance, hope, or luck. You can do that in 5 minutes to a targeted person or group with deliberation at will and with certainty.
And I can imagine now my internal communications listeners' ears have suddenly pricked up now, thinking, okay, I want to hear more. So when we're talking about icon, I guess icon for some people is synonymous with something that's very scarce, very rare, very out of touch to a certain extent, perhaps. But I think what you're talking about is something that's actually within all of our reaches if we kind of just do the right thing. So just define what you mean by icon in this context. I think that's a really
I think an icon is anything that's emblazed in our minds. In other words, if we have a monolithic concept, like I have a dream is an iconic statement, okay? The Campbell soup can is by Warhol is an iconic image. The McDonald's M is an iconic image. What they all have in common is they carry with them a vast amount of information. When we hear the words, I have a dream, we can almost imagine the entire speech. So it's like a donkey. Same thing with if we're driving down a highway and we see the M, we can almost see the entire menu, right? And if the same thing with the soup can. We might start thinking about Marilyn Monroe or the Mao or Warhol or the factory. So these monoliths, there's an incredible relationship that exists between a monolithic thing that's emblazed in our head and the complex information that we all need for the world to go around. And I explain that information with a lot of research as well as stories in my book.
Yeah. And so we're talking about this summary for something far more complex, something that is encapsulates a whole bunch of emotions and thoughts and feelings and knowledge in something that is in essence a summary. And we're not just talking about visual summaries, and we'll come on to a little bit about what an icon actually is in a moment. And you mentioned, you know, Martin Luther King. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, one of your great philosophers, John Locke, the guy, you know, the tabula rasa blank, we're all born a blank slate man. He said that dice or toy blocks were the best way for children to learn. And so, you know, I kind of take a quote from him, and then I kind of expound on the relationship between the complex information that we all need for the world to go around and the monolithic. People need an anchor for all complex information. And what happens is, as we teach children this way, but as we get above elementary learning, we stop communicating to each other in elementary ways. So what I'm explaining in The Iconist is that adults crave this childlike elementary communication and learn better with it and take in knowledge better with it and get inspired by it even more than children do. And in a world overloaded with content where there's nothing to grab onto and everything's screaming at you, the adult world, the economic world, the communications world is starving for these monoliths to be attached to the information that we're trying to convey.
Yeah. I want to explore that a little bit more because I think that's highly relevant to the people who are going to be listening to this show. This idea of why it's so important now, and a couple of things. Well, there's many really amazing sort of concepts in the book, but a couple of really I really latched onto is this scarcity of attention and the dilution effect. I think they're sort of hand in hand, but just talk us through why being an iconist or why using icons or blocks, as we're going to go on to explore. Why is that so significant now? Why are we in need of this sort of primitive, primeval, really kind of cutting through the noise type communication at the moment?
Well, if you look at, human evolution of the last, it's been 100, 200,000 years, depending on what scientist you talk to. In the last 25 to 30 years, like a light switch, we've gone from the way that the amount of messaging that's thrown at us every day in the blink of an eye has gone from zero to 100,000. I mean, it's an overwhelming torrent that we couldn't even process a fraction of. And not too many people are talking about it. And when they do talk about it, they talk about it in terms of attention span. When I talk about this concept of information overload, messaging overload, and I'll give you a breakdown of that in a second, I'm more interested in this. People are constantly distracted all the time. There was a woman that I talk about in my book named Linda Stone in the late 90s. She was doing research for Microsoft and Apple, and she coined the term continuous partial attention to talk about how people were being so bombarded with messaging by the late 90s, before the internet was even in the full swing, before social media, 10 years before Twitter and Facebook and started getting going. Okay, she was talking about this concept of continuous partial attention, of how we were only partially paying attention because of all of the messaging that was being thrown at us. Okay, so lots of people are talking about this. What I'm concerned with, and where I focus on the book, is I'm less concerned with the fact that we're all distracted, which is its own problem and needs to be dealt with. But I'm concerned with what that's doing to the people that are trying to get their offering in the world. There's a lot of people that have amazing things they're trying to bring to the world, and they don't even know. They have a feeling of absolute angst and anxiety because they can't get engagement anymore. And it has devastating psychological effects to the person presenting the offering. And then we all miss out because there's all these valid offerings that are just getting lost in an ocean of content. So to give you a specific example of what I'm talking about, if you were to be the average person, in the UK or American walking around their town or their village in 1950, you would have been exposed to about 250 advertising messages a day between the telly and just billboards and magazines. Okay. Yeah. By 1970, that was up to 1,000. By 1998, when Linda Stone coined the term continuous partial attention, before the internet was even rolling, really, it was up to 5,000 to 7,000. Today, estimates with all the Google ads and all the different social medias and Snapchat and Instagram and, all the text messages, all of it counts, right? It's up to maybe 10 to 15,000.
Yeah.
Well, the truth is you couldn't process 1,000.
No.
So there's psychological effects that come from that. We don't see everything. We always feel like something's undone. But most importantly, we don't feel like we can get the attention for the things that we used to be able to 10 years ago. It was easier than now. And 10 years before that, it's completely buried and diluted us. And it makes us feel invisible.
Yeah.
Because we're now, if you were a baker in 1950s, Sussex, okay, you were competing with one other baker in the town. In America, with online bakeries, same thing. You might have been competing with two other bakers in your town. Now you're competing with 1,000 bakers. And that applies to everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's dilution. I mean, I give the example in the book of the job search, right?
Yeah.
Like if you were to turn in your resume, I mean, just to give you an example of how many things this applies to, if you were to try to turning a red, if I saw an ad in the New York Times and I lived outside New York City in 1950 and I applied for a job, I might be going in with 20, 30 resumes. Now with online job boards, I'm going in with 1,000 resumes.
Yeah.
Well, it's not like there's massive HR departments that are like examining these resumes with great rigor. You're now one in 1,000. Everything is like that now. Everything.
So it's incumbent. And I guess that raises for me, because I guess in the wrong hands, I know we've got some way to go yet and to kind of really explore this, but I heard you talking on another podcast that I listened, I caught that you were on as well. You were talking around, you know, that maybe some people feel slightly manipulative, that they're using, you know, when they do get to do this really well, and, you know, we've seen, you know, without naming any names, we know there are people in the world at the moment that are using probably what you might describe as blocks in ways that are not necessarily.
What are you talking about? I don't know who you could possibly be talking about.
Well, not limited to your side of the pond, I hasten to add.
Of course not.
No. So I guess it's incumbent on, you know, this I'm almost trying to think, it's like strange Jedi powers that come with this ability to use blocks effectively, comes with a sense of using it, you know, and maybe we're too far ahead and maybe we need to dial back a bit in this conversation. But I'm just trying to think, you know, that might be a reservation that people have, that, you know, using this stuff is maybe too manipulative, maybe it's too powerful.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would say a couple things. I mean, you know, first of all, HBO made a movie about Brexit called Brexit with Benedict Cumberbatch, which is the entire movie is the subject of making a phrase that can cause a change. Okay. Mm. Not a slogan, but something that can actually move the people, the way that "We Shall Fight" move the people for Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
To galvanize British support to carry, you know, to make them have the resolve to carry out to the end of the war. Right.
Yeah.
So these monoliths cannot just get a scene. They can inspire people. Right. And then HBO made a movie about how one phrase made the difference for Brexit. I don't know if that's true, but it's a very compelling film.
So
we're talking about, you know, John Locke and Churchill, you know, God, this is becoming a very British show. But to your point, to mention another Brit, you know, basically, if you take what George Orwell was saying in his dystopian nightmare 1984 about repetitive monolithic communication, he's basically saying this type of communication is nefarious. Okay.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, it's not nefarious and it's not good. It just is. It's like a rock. It's like saying a rock is nefarious. It's the way all human beings prefer to take in all information. A kid's picture book works the same way that, you know, 1984 works, but we don't call it nefarious.
No.
So what I'm saying, you know, so what I'm saying is that this is how human beings prefer to take in information. They want to be anchored to monoliths.
Yeah.
So I teach you how to use it for good. It also, these monoliths get greatly amplified when you're being transparent. And, you know, all they do is get people to focus on you.
Yeah.
So
it's the difference between manipulation and influence, isn't it? You know, it's a very fine line. Influence is merely manipulation with positive intent. And we use two different, you know, words to essentially describe the same thing, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of silly, really. Like we need to be able to relay communication. We need to be able to get people to see us. We need everybody on the same page. And the way that you do this is with monolithic communication. I have a chapter in the book called Road Signs. And I basically say, you know, we when it comes to life and death, we always communicate this way. Right. With a stop sign, there's billions of them, but we pay attention to them because they're monolithic and they have negative space around them and there's nothing competing for it. Same thing with the warning labels. You know, we don't drink poison because we use these monoliths to make us know that there's poison there. Right. So what the book examines is there something about a warning label or a road sign that we can apply to everything to get our offering seen and heard in a world where we're so bombarded, everything has become more diluted and invisible. Scarcity of attention. When Bill Taylor, the founder of Fast Company, co-founder of Fast Company, reviewed my book, he said, "Scarcity of attention is the defining business challenge of our time." Yeah. I would say scarcity of attention is the defining business and social challenge of our time. But I thought it was a very eloquent way of putting it.
Yeah, I agree. I concur. Let's go there then. I've read the book. Is this when we talk about these kind of enduring elements? These are what we refer to by block theory itself. These are what make up that block theory. Is that correct?
I basically say yes. I basically say that no matter how complex your company is, you need to distill yourself down to 1 to 3 points as a portal so that people can enter into the full complexity of who you are. Yeah. If you're presenting more than 2 points when you're communicating to your employees, more than 2 or 3 points, or on your website to your customers, you're losing them. In a world, and I would make this statement, this will be the definitive quote of the book. I don't even know that I say it in the book. Okay. Mm. But in a world overloaded with content, if you don't present something that someone can understand in a microsecond before they have a chance to even think, you've lost them. They're moving on. Mm. They will not see you. Okay. I'll say it like this. In a world overloaded with content, if you don't communicate in a microsecond before someone has a chance to think, anything that does not get understood in a microsecond before one has a chance to think is instantly discarded.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. I mean, I know from my own lack of attention, and I think the interesting thing about what we're talking about here, and just thinking about this from the recipient's point of view, and you're absolutely right. I mean, the amount of guilt I feel that I've missed out on really important stuff, but I just haven't had time because it's either not come across in the right way, or it's not been presented in the right way, or I've prioritized it in an instant and said, that's not relevant, or I'm just not got time to read that, or I'm not got time to process it.
Can I expand on that for one second?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I mean, let's give a practical example of this so we're not just talking conceptually, right? So say you do a Google search and there's 10 things that come up, but that you've got 100 million search results. So you're instantly overwhelmed by that. So you're going to only look at the first 10.
Yeah.
Okay? So there's a formula for actually in my book for creating something that's going to cause the person to stop at you and look at your specifics. Okay? Yeah. So there's an intersect point between the best you have to offer as in that category and what your potential customer cares about emotionally. Mm. And you find that intersect point, which is never a slogan or a tagline. A slogan or a tagline is a desperate attempt to find just a statement of the problem you solve or why you do what you do that will resonate with the customer. And you blow it up overly large like Sesame Street.
Yeah.
If you did that, and you were in the top 10 and someone looked at all 10, 90% of the time they would stop and engage with you. And that's absolutely true for internal comms as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talking internally to your employees. Yeah.
So I want to maybe, you're right. I think we maybe made some practical examples, but just before we do that, I want to kind of delve into what some of these elements are, because I think the components are actually where it really starts to resonate and become practical and something you can do. So in the book, you talk about it being concentrated, simple, monolithic, massive, large, instantly understandable with an emotional visceral connection and something that is repeated. So I'd like to just kind of unpick those, and maybe, you know, time wise we can't go through all of them in the same level of detail. Okay. I'll just let you expand on that and maybe illustrate that with a few examples. I think would be really good. Does every block have to have, and we're talking about blocks, we haven't actually defined what we mean by blocks.
I created the word block from what happens when you put a toy block in front of a baby.
Right.
So a toy block is large and they'll stare at it, but they're not just staring at this monolithic thing that's put in front of them. There's also some sort of shape or letter and animal in it, or car or object. And so there's this powerful magnetism that exists when there's a complexity existing within a monolithically simple thing. Okay. Mm. So if you present that and then you repeat it over and over, a block is basically an icon waiting to happen. When we think of something iconic, we think of something that has to be in the collective consciousness of millions and millions of people. It doesn't. It just needs to be in the collective consciousness of your target, whether it's your employees or your customers. Mm-hmm. So you can take a monolith, and I teach you the formula again in the book of how to create one, and you repeat it over and over to your customer set of potential customers or your employees. And then in a matter of minutes rather than months or hours, it will be blazed into their mind with the same, if you use repetition and monoliths, it will blaze in their mind and magnetize engagement the same way something like I Have a Dream does. It'll just be to your targeted audience. Okay. So at the point that your potential customers take that repetitive statement, and I can give you an example of what one is, into their mind, it's no longer what I call a block. It's now the common icon. So all a block is a repetitive statement, a repetitive dominant melody, a repetitive simple. I explain how it works in art and culture and all these other things. It's this repetitive monolith that's now been taken into the mind, and it then ceases to be a block and is now an icon. So blocks are the anatomy of what causes something to become iconic to your intended audience.
Yeah. When we're talking about a monolith, just describe, just explain what we mean by monolith, because people will be thinking of it, it's like some sort of statue or, you know, a kind of a piece of a carved stone. Okay. What do we mean when we're talking about monolith?
So I'll just kind of roll through how it would work in different mediums. Okay. So if you're in public speaking, it would, like if you take the most famous speech in human history, it would probably be the I Have a Dream speech. It's a very short speech of just over 1,600 words. He repeats the repetitive phrase, I have a dream, approximately every 85 words. It's the repetition of that phrase that is the reason we remember the entire body and sentiment of the speech. It's why We Shall Fight, when he did that famous speech before the House of Commons in 1940, I think it was, that was the end of the speech. It was his closer. It wasn't called the We Shall Fight speech. That's what we call it now. It's the reason the speech became the speech. So it's a monolith. And when you're dealing with something conceptual, it's a monolithic repetitive phrase. If you're dealing with something visual, you know, if you look at like who are the two most known artists in the world in our collective consciousness, if you were to go even to, you know, walk up to the average working stiff on the street who knows nothing about art, they might not recognize a Picasso, but they would recognize a Van Gogh or a Warhol. Why? Because they use monoliths, you know, a man with a cob pipe, a cafe, a bedroom, flowers, a pair of boots. You recognize the image before you have a chance to think. Same with Warhol, a soup can, a Marilyn Monroe, a Mao. There's not even a microsecond before you see it and you know what it is. If you use things like that and you blow them up oversized Sesame Street style, people lock on. They can't not do it. It's like a stop sign. And then if what you have there is valid, they will further engage. It's like a Jedi mind trick. I mean, it's funny that you use that example because I don't like to use that example because this is working for practical examples. But between you and me, I often think of it like that.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and again, I mentioned it earlier, and it kind of really resonated for me because we, you know, the work that we do with a big picture people is, we'd always kind of struggle to sort of understand ourselves why it worked. We stumbled across this sort of idea, but this idea of using this kind of big, massive visualization and then repeating that across the organization, but using it as a way of summarizing all of that complexity that the organization was facing was, I guess, where, you know, the kind of, it really resonated for me. This idea of it being massive, why, I mean, you've talked about the kind of Sesame Street and, you know, that will definitely translate into the UK so that you don't need to worry about that. But I'm just kind of wondering, you know, this massiveness, why is the massiveness significant in the context? Well,
there's research in the book that, that shows that the part of our brain, because they can do brain scans when we're doing different activities and they can see what lights up, right? So they've done research that proves that when we look at imagery, what lights up in our brain is 10 times more than what lights up in our brain when we're dealing with words or letters or something complicated. Okay. So there's actual brain science that explains that like picture imagery, large imagery, has a more profound physical effect on us, right? So, the other answer that's, you know, it's funny, it's an interesting question. Nobody's ever quite answered it to me before. There's been a lot of studies that part of it is just that there's so much being bombarded at us that when something is overly large, you know, our lizard brain says, why is that overly large? Mm. And then something else that occurs in our lizard brain is, if you get the statement right, and I can give an example of some of these statements, conceptually, it builds instant credibility, because if something is overly large and it's very definitive, you go, wow, this person really means it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you spoke about it in the book, actually. I think you did anyway. I don't think there was a connection I made myself. I'm pretty sure you did. You talked about the, you know, the kind of that feeling you get when you see a big mountain quite close up. Was that in the book?
There's like hard research in the book, and then there's my speculations. So if you go back 50,000 years before any real kind of advanced technology, right, you know, the only things, you know, the things that allowed us to survive were monolithic, you know, the things that impressed upon us as a developing species were monolithic. Mountains, if you look at a mountain and just how monolithic it is, well, it doesn't, it represents great complexity. It represents food, represents shelter, right? Yeah. If you were trying to travel through the night, moon represented light, this monolithic orb, right? So I think there's a primal part of our development that forces us to fixate, if ever so momentarily, on anything that's presented in an overly large monolithic fashion. And I teach you how to deploy that in the book.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing that resonated for me on that one as well, and I think we talked about this in another conversation that we'd had, was around, you know, the church used to use cathedrals in Europe to kind of build that kind of sense of awe and breath, taking your breath away when you go into one of those places, in terms of, you know, creating that almost spiritual feeling that, you know, at the time when people were kind of living in much more basic conditions, you can imagine how that would have, again, created that kind of visceral connection with you know, what the emotion they were trying to generate at the time as well, and creating that kind of almost heaven on earth sort of paradigm or feeling as well.
It's not a coincidence.
No. The emotion, absolutely. And the emotional connection thing that you've also put in the sort of what makes an effective block as well, I think is another one that I think sometimes I've done a lot of work with organizational change in the past. And I'm a great fan of, you know, kind of people like John Cotter and the sense of urgency and his whole thing about, you know, you need to see and feel things before you're willing to change. You can't just rationalize things. You know, looking at a spreadsheet, you've got to kind of actually get out there and see a customer who's not happy, and that kind of visceral connection is what drives fundamental change. And I guess that's what's at the heart of what you're talking about when you're talking about blocks and that
emotion. Yeah, I mean, I think another, you know, to quote another Brit, like a Freudian slip right there. Simon Sinek's book about, you know, start with why. There's a lot of truth in that. I wouldn't say that I would add to that. And I would say start with why, or start with the result you achieve. Businesses exist to solve problems. You know, internal communications exist to solve problems. So start with why you're doing what you're doing, how in a way that that corresponds to the emotional concern of who you're trying to talk to, or start with the result you achieve for them in a way that's most emotional for them. Mm-hmm. And then they will lock on and be interested in the complexity. The reason people don't speak in these monoliths is because people are complicated, and they do vast things. And when you do something and you've got 100 moving parts, it is very difficult to turn around and go, but I'm just going to lead with one. Mm. So if the iconist does one thing, it's to teach you how to bring it down to that one thing. Can I give some examples of that?
Please do. Yeah. I think it's important. Yeah.
Okay. So let's give I'll give an example, kind of an advertising example, and then I'll give a business survival example. Both, I think, are in the book. You know, one is in the 1970s in America, before fax machines, before the internet, FedEx came up with this phrase. And it's really important to understand this difference between a slogan and a tagline and a block. A slogan and a tagline are weak. They're the enemy. They're desperate. Okay. Mm. And what they're doing, but it does show a desperate human need to try to come up with a simplicity to lead with. That's why people come up with them, even though they're horrible. Like, Coke adds life. No, it doesn't. Okay. Have a Coke and a smile. Well, I have a Coke and then I feel like I want to crash and fall asleep an hour later. I'm not trying to bash Coke, right? But like Hostess was a brand all over the world that had preservative baked goods. And it would say wholesome Hostess. It's not true. It's a lie. It's not wholesome. So these are all slogans and taglines, and they're repulsive. So there's a big difference between a tagline, a slogan, or a block. Slogans are desperate general statements that repulse people, that feel advertorial. And you have to understand that we live in a world where there's so much advertising. And another word for advertising is a self-promotional, unsubstantiated claim.
Yeah.
This is true internally and externally. Another word for an unsubstantiated claim is a lie. So we're being bombarded with lies. Now, we may come out and tell the truth about our product or service or tell our employees, but no one cares because you're in a climate of liars. Okay. So, back to Simon's book, I do agree with what Simon says about the why, but I also think it's about the result you achieve. And I also think you have to really understand your audience and what they care about emotionally. But where I would go further than Simon is to say, if you don't blow that why or that result statement up, that emotional statement up massively like Sesame Street, doesn't matter. No one's going to see it. No one's going to hear it. It has to be oversized to the point where and repetitive to the point where it makes you uncomfortable or it does nothing. So to give you, so back to this FedEx example, Federal Express in the 1970s, before fax machines and the internet, they came up with the phrase, when it absolutely positively has to be there overnight. Okay. Now, in a time with no internet and fax machines, with valuable documents like an inheritance, a land or a house purchase, any sort of business contract that was time sensitive, when it absolutely positively has to be there overnight, is a gut punch. It's a statement of result. That is a block. That repeated is a block. That's the difference between McDonald's, I'm loving it. That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And you might be loving it when you're eating it, but 30 minutes in, you're not, when it's in your gut like a hockey puck, you're not loving it. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the difference between, and there's a business example in the book that I'd love to give, a story that I'd like to tell, because I think it's really relevant to the time. Is that okay?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Okay. So, about 100 years ago in the early 1930s, in the deep heart of the Great Depression, there was a guy named Ted Houston. He was married to a woman named Dorothy Houston. And the world was in a global depression. And he inherited $3,000. And he had just graduated from pharmacy school. And this guy had really a simple, very clear plan for his life. Okay. He wanted to open a pharmacy. He wanted to raise a family, and he wanted to live somewhere where he could attend Catholic mass. These were the things that were important to him. So he moved to a small town in South Dakota called Wall, South Dakota. Okay. And he took that money, which would have been a fortune back then, and he opened his pharmacy. Well, he quickly realized in the Great Depression that the town was with 327 people living in it was busted broke, and nobody was coming into his store, and panic set in that his life was going to fall apart. And he had one thing going for him, that there was a interstate that went by the town, Route 16A, where weathered jalopies just cruised by in massive volume. They just didn't come into the town. Well, one day his wife, Dorothy, said, what is it that these people in their, aging, their sun-beaten jalopies need more than anything when they're driving by? And she said, cold ice water, right? That's something they had that the people driving by emotionally needed. It didn't even relate to the pharmacy. This is how powerful this tool is. So they made... So she got the idea that they would make a massive billboard and put it on Route 16A. So they made this massive billboard and they erected it, and it said, free ice water, Wall Drug. Okay. And they erected this thing. And before they got, this is 1932.
Yeah.
Before they even got back to the pharmacy, they were mobbed. Okay. And that business, yeah. That business is now, you could say that was the world's first viral business.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I could go on and on about how like that virility continued during World War II, the Allied forces would put up signs, distance to wall drug. People took wall drug signs. Taj Mahal, Great Wall of China, took pictures with them all over the world. And today, wall drug is a thriving compound.
Right.
It's a national landmark in South Dakota. So,
an icon.
Or not a state landmark in South Dakota, an icon in South Dakota. So, so that's the difference between, you know, what most people would have done. And so why that's relevant now is we're living, in a time of recession and of uncertainty, where there's been some uncertainty. And if they can do that then and thrive, then you can thrive now.
You can do it now.
Yeah.
So I want to use that as a metaphor, because that's what we like using metaphors in our work, is our listeners are the internal communication managers. They've got this highway passing their window, or, you know, down the back end of their block, and they can see all these cars passing by. They've got these messages, which is this kind of, they've got messages they want to get out to those people driving along. They want those cars to pull by and listen and you know, drop by and they've got that cool ice cool water, but they're struggling to think about how they can get that traffic off the highway to pull by their store. That's our metaphor. That's the internal comms people in the store, sure, with their ice water.
I get it.
Their employee. How can they use block theory? What are some of the signs they need to put up to get that traffic diverting through their store?
I think to answer that question first, I need to create just a little bit of context. Okay.
Yeah.
You have to go back to the second industrial revolution. You have to go back to the turn of the 19th to the 20th century and mass production, which is really when Britain kind of stopped being the global force that it was. And actually for very good reason, mass production was kind of anathema to the British way of thinking. You know, things are handmade. They need to be done right. Portland is all about that. That's what we represent here. And I kind of think like that as a maker. So mass production was kind of anathema to the British. And that's why the Germans and the Japanese in America were kind of able to rise. They had no problem with it. Well, if you think about mass production and the rise of factories, like mass production factories, not the kind of factories that existed in cities maybe a couple of hundred years before as they emerged, but mass production factories, it's all about how many widgets you can make in a day, okay? So we develop these top-down management structures. Just, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be nice to people. You don't have to be their friend. You just have to get them to make more widgets, okay? And that worked really well 100 years ago. And what's happened is it's 100 years later, or, you know, a little more than 100 years later. I guess that started in maybe 1880. To 1910, right? 20. Yeah. And it's more than 100 years later. And we still have that kind of way of managing inside our companies. The problem is with this light switch of technology change, most companies are involved in that. So everything now is about adaptability. It's not about top down how many widgets you can make in a day. It's about how quickly can you get the next faster version out that everybody wants. Mm-hmm. It's about speed. Okay, so that top-down management structure does not work at all when you need people to move with speed, when you need people to adapt, because that is something where they have to be empowered to do that. Okay, and that's the disconnect and the friction and the struggle that a lot of companies are dealing with. They have these top-down management structures, but they need people to feel empowered. And I think that's a major problem in Western companies. Okay.
And I agree. I think, you know, a lot of people will be going, well, it's not like that in my company. But I think what you're talking about is not just, you know, we've got funky cushions and plasma TVs on the wall and a really nice canteen where they do kind of, you know, vegan stuff. What we're talking about here is like, it's that fundamental premise, which there are people at the top of the organization controlling resources and information flows. And that is still very,
if you have a person on an assembly line and they quit, and then you the talent turnover costs you nothing. There's another guy waiting to take over that job.
Yeah.
In an information society, talent turnover costs a lot of money. right? So if the employees don't feel like they have buy-in, if they don't feel relevant, if they don't feel like they have power, they're not effective, and they move on, and it costs you a lot of money. Talent turnover, it gets really expensive. And I mean, I could go on and on about all the reasons why. It's more about the engagement of your employees.
Yeah.
If your employees are not engaged in an information economy, you're experiencing a thing that I call drag. Even if you're doing well, you're losing money. You could be doing weller. You could be making more money. You could be being more profitable. And most CEOs and C-level executives and HR, they feel this. They feel an angst about the fact, hey, we're doing really well, but something's off, right?
Yeah.
And I call that feeling drag. The fact that they know they could be taking more market share if they were more efficient in their communications externally and internally.
Yeah. So what can we do? So we've got that kind of post, kind of Henry Ford's structures within our organizations. How can we start to use, is it more fundamental than just using?
Well, one thing you can do, I just took on a client that does an employee engagement survey that I think blew my mind. It was one of the first times I've ever kind of pursued a client. I mean, it's a really ugly, they look like it was made in the 90s. And I went to these people. They were sent to me, and I had a conversation with them, and they kind of were lukewarm. But then I did their survey, and I was blown away by how much it captured my engagement. And so I went to them and I said, this is a tool for business change and social change. You guys are crazy not to make this accessible. And they listened to me. So now we're engaging, right? If you can't do that, the answer to your question is most people can get a read by talking to who has most proximity to their employees, most repetitive proximity to their employees, what they care about. So, obviously the reason a company like yours exists, Craig Smith, is because, you teach people how to distill. I'm not trying to do a commercial for you. I mean, it's kind of why we connected in a way. It was why I was interested in talking to you. You teach people to distill everything down to this monolithic simplicity so that everyone can be on the same page. And the reason that no one ever does it is because it's hard to decide one out of 100 things to have your company when you can only have your company on the page about over 1 to 3 things. So you bring them through a rigor and a process that gets them to do that. Right. And that's why, what you and I had in common. And so, maybe that goes back to one of the first questions you asked me in the conversation, which is what is an iconist? Yeah. An iconist is somebody that feels the discomfort of knowing they have to distill something down to 1 to 3 things and how painful that feels to even think about and does it anyway.
Yeah.
Because I talk about in the book reasons why people don't do this so that they will look at themselves and they'll throw that out. Right.
Yeah. Okay. I totally agree. I mean, it's one of the things I often say is that I think sometimes, and we find this, and we are very open about this, is sometimes organizations kind of suffer from a mild form or not even a mild form of attention deficit disorder, that they just want to do everything. And that, it's like they're running around like kids in a sort of a toy shop grabbing things. And sometimes the hardest conversations we have with them are let's not communicate necessarily what we are going to do. Let's communicate what we're going to stop doing. And nobody likes to talk about what they're going to stop doing because it feels like it's a failure or whatever. And getting that out to make them realize that if you're going to kind of focus on 1 or 2, 3 things, that means there's maybe 30 or 40 things you're not going to focus on. let's be crystal clear about that. And that's always the hardest conversation, I think.
I think what I like about what you do is you bring them through a rigor so they can have a certainty. And that's for your company's for the people that don't feel like they can do it on their own. My book might put you out of business, Craig Smith.
No, I think it's very complimentary.
No, it's complimentary. It's complimentary.
Highly complimentary.
Highly complimentary.
It's the science behind the you know, it's the secret sauce that we.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree. And you know, so but to back to your kind of earlier question about like kind of a road, you know, one of the metaphors I give in the book about a road, you know, is you have to imagine that all your employees are on this like massive information highway, okay, and there's more to do than they can possibly figure out to do. You want them all on the same page. So you have to look at like having everyone on the same page means more productivity, more efficiency, more output. There's so many benefits from it. Less employee turnover and more happy humans, which we should care about in the world, right?
Yeah.
So if you present an emotional block that they all care about, and most of the time there'll be some internal thing that relates to the mission of the company externally, that also relates to what they care about and will give them passion internally. If you present that exit to them in an oversized way, they will get off at that exit one for one as a collective.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the metaphor I think you were kind of using.
Yeah,
so I just
definitely
wanted to complete the metaphor.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice. Yeah, it's nice to close the circle. Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, the things we people get most passionate about, and again, it's different for different companies. It's their customers. It's the communities they serve. It's their heritage. It's their workmates and the community that within the organization. If you can kind of relate that to long-term success of the organization and doing what we need you to do in order to sustain that stuff, and it's genuine, and it's not just a, you know, like you were saying earlier, a kind of a catchphrase or a catchline. And that's kind of manipulative, then that's
most of the time they're not even manipulative. They're just silly and they repulse people. Like Lehman Brothers had one saying, you know, no family left behind.
Yeah.
And you could say until 2008, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, but there's so many of these. I mean, in the 50s, you had phrases like a cigarette a day keeps the doctor away. Camel campaign. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And what's so silly is that it continues to this day when you watch adverts on TV, you know, it's like the March of the Wooden Soldiers. Like it just goes on and on and on, even though it's stupid and repulsive. It repulses people. And it's not new that it repulses people. There's a guy who was one of the grandfathers of modern advertising. He wrote a book with Jack Trout in the 1970s, Positioning the Battle for Your Mind. It's one of the most influential books in the history of advertising. About 15 years ago, Al Reese, who was one of the writers of that previous book, wrote a book with his daughter called The Fall of Advertising. And he talks about how these slogans repulse people. That's 15 years ago.
Okay? Yeah.
So if it was repulsing people 15 years ago, what is it doing to them now, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and again, I've gone into organizations and done this internally. And one last thing I'll say, you know, about this for internal communications is this. One way the world's changed in the last 25 to 30 years is it used to be 30 years ago before the internet was rolling that what you would say to your customers and what you would say to your employees would be maybe very, very different things. Okay. Mm. But now we all have access to the same information. So typically what's going to cause your customers to your employees to be inspired, you'll find will also work externally and drive business and engagement to you as a block as well.
Yeah. 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 We talked about that actually in the very first episode. We had a great interviewee there and that was all about the alignment between the external brand and the internal brand and how they had to be completely congruent with each other in modern organizations.
Yeah, they do because everybody has access to the same information.
Exactly.
I think if you're focused on communicating to your customers in a way that truly engages the problems you solve for them, and then you use that same thing internally, that's going to impassion your employees.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Meaning. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, look, Jamie, it's been absolutely fantastic. I we're not finished yet. There's a couple of things I want to finish off with. I will finish off with some links to mention just to, you know, if people do want to reach out to you, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who do want to talk to you. But I did forewarn you. I always end a show with something we didn't know about you or something you're even people who know you quite well may not know about you. So, and it'd be great to know what you'd like to share with us in terms of, you know, what is a sort of a thing that you know, is a sort of a little story about Jamie that not a lot of people know, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, there's a crazy story. Can I do, I could say a couple of things, a tandem.
Go on then. Okay? Go on, I'll let you.
One is that, you know, I grew up in abject poverty, abandoned by my parents in downtown Los Angeles, near downtown Los Angeles. And I had limited contact with my parents till I was about 7 years old. And I grew up in the worst kind of poverty you can imagine. I was semi-literate till I was 19 years old. I tried to get my life together when I was 19. I had a resource, a relative that said I could stay at their house as long as I was in school. It was the first time I didn't have to deal with poverty and all those burdens in my entire life. And I went semi-literate from a remedial college classes at a community college in the United States to the graduating from the London School of Economics in just over 5 years.
Wow.
So I've experienced what it's like to feel and be invisible. It's why I care so much about it.
Hmm.
And then the other thing is what led me to kind of write this book was I had a massive business failure and I had to do some soul searching as to how and why it happened. And it wasn't just, it was, there were economics involved, but the thing that I realized with that massive business failure, which occurred over 15 years ago, was that it forced me to take a step back and say, what are you good at? What are you great at? Mm. Are you great at being an entrepreneur? Are you great at something else? What are you great at? And I looked at what I was really thought I was good at. And I decided in that moment of failure to go tunnel vision on my strengths.
Mm.
So there's two things that I don't normally talk about.
No, that's amazing. And you know, I kind of, I know that I won't spoil it because I'll let people buy the book and read it. You know, there's an amazing story at the end of your book, which really captured my attention because I listened to the book, I listened to the audio version of it, and you actually read that. So yeah, I didn't expect anything less in terms of impact. But I think that's two amazing stories, and you know, and without sounding, you know, kind of trite, you know, the whole story of, and obviously you shared that in the book as well. You know, the fact that you, where you came from, and I heard you talking about it on other podcasts as well, you know, is an amazing testament to, you know, don't ever write people off in terms of, you know, where their background or where they come from, or you know, I think what you've proven is possible within the human spirit and with the right focus and the right attention is just an incredible story. So yeah, it's thank you for sharing that. I think it really resonates. Maybe we should have had that at the beginning of the that would have been the block to get everybody to listen to the rest of the show, which I'm sure they will anyway. So look, Jamie, where can people find out more about you? I've got at the Jamie Mustard if people like Twitter. I've got the iconist.org, which is your website, and I've also got the link to the book as well, which is the iconist.
I think I'm Jamie_Mustard on Instagram.
Are you? Okay. Yeah. On Jamie_Mustard on Instagram.
And I will say, you know, this read the afterword of the book. Some people tell me that it should have been the first chapter. So if you do get the book, make sure you read the afterword.
Is that the story that
I would? Yeah, the story you're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Yeah, that in itself, I think, is a block, and it's a great illustration of what a block is actually. Because I think it being at the end is actually, yeah. I don't know. I think does a block always need to be at the beginning? Perhaps I don't know. Maybe that.
Yeah. I'm proud of the rest of it too, but please, you know, I'm just saying, don't forget to read it.
And it's a tremendous book. And Jamie, we will have to close. I know the actual aesthetics of the book as well is a work of art. How long is that? Because I think you said that was maybe not, we're going to keep that infinitely in this beautiful format that it's in at the moment, because it is actually extremely tactile and beautiful.
Yeah,
to hold.
It's a jacketless hardcover. And the word from my publisher is that will probably never change.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
okay.
But, you know. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, my book is a proof of concept.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, they can also go to the Iconist or the Iconist, if you're in England, .org. Yeah. The Iconist.org. And I love to hear from people. I help everyone. I walk the walk because of what my life has been. I will try to help people, even if they, you know, can't afford it. So if something's resonating with you and you're like, maybe I should contact him, but he's busy, don't think like that. Send me an email and you'll hear back from me, unless I'm, you know, most likely immediately. And I'll engage with you. And, you know, no matter what, I mean, I it's all I do all day is engage with people on this subject.
Yeah. No, and I will concur with that, because I kind of reached out to you kind of thinking I would get some sort of, automated response that Jamie was too busy, and you responded very quickly and were very, very approachable. So I you know, that isn't just talk. I know you're very helpful, Jamie. So look, it's been absolutely awesome talking to you. You know, I do class you as a genuine thought leader, and being able to speak to someone with such unique and powerful ideas, and be able to sort of, spend some time with you exploring that, has been a real honor. So thank you very much.
And thank you for having me. I love the interview. I think that I don't think I've ever done an interview, such a natural conversation quite like this.
Well, that's great.
About such powerful things. So no, it was very, I think you brought some things out that I hadn't talked about, and it was very, I liked it.
Fantastic. Well, I loved it too. Well, take care, Jamie. Look after yourself, and I'm looking forward to listening back to this interview when we actually put it out there.
Cheers.
Take care.
Bye.
So thank you for listening to Engaging Internal Comms. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the show, and any questions, ideas, or feedback that you'd have, anything you'd like us to cover on future episodes too, please. So you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us via the contact form at engagingic.com. You can also sign up to our mailing list there, and we'll send you relevant news about the show and anything that we think you might be interested in when it comes to internal communications and employee engagement. If you like the show and you haven't already done so, please subscribe to it directly via your podcast service. And you can also subscribe via the links on our podcast page, which again is engagingic.com. If you like the show, we'd be really grateful if you could leave us a review, and also if you could leave some verbal feedback there as well, not just stars. That's always nice to know that we've been appreciated, and particularly how we've helped you. If you know anyone else who might like the show or might benefit from it, please tell them, please share it with them, please share the link to our website, engagingic.com. And that will be great, because we want to grow our community. We want to get as many people involved in the show as possible. And the bigger, the better. Okay, thank you.